This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. On today's roundtable, could a 20-year-old memo on wiretapping be a new sticking point in the confirmation of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court? Also, George Bush asks the editors of leading newspapers to stop publishing unflattering stories on the White House. And the end of re-gifting? Preliminary numbers show fewer people are returning their Christmas gifts. We'll ask our roundtable if they were naughty or nice and if they're headed back to the store to return any of their Christmas presents. Joining us today to discuss these topics from our bureau in New York are Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. At our Washington, D.C. headquarters, Republican strategist Tara Settmeyer, and George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, is in Laurel, Maryland. How are all of you doing today?
Good to be with you.
Doing fine.
Glad to have you. Let's start out talking about Alito. You know, he's been criticized for memos that he has written against Roe v. Wade and his handling of civil rights cases, but this wiretapping story seems to me has caused quite a firestorm. Could this be the issue that undoes his nomination? Tara, let's start with you.
Well, I think that given what has taken place in the last couple weeks, I think this is now going to be the centerpiece of the nomination hearings. Before, everyone was concerned about the abortion Roe v. Wade litmus test, but now we have a new element introduced. But what we need to understand here is that the memo that we're referencing in 1984 was written while he was in the capacity as an assistant in the Solicitor General's office. And in that capacity, his job is to protect the interests of the executive branch. That's what the Solicitor General's office does. And what he did, he didn't actually address the issue of whether warrants were needed to investigate foreign threats or one of the main issues at hand with the National Security Agency wiretapping issue right now with the administration. That issue was never taken up in this memo. And also the core, the crux of this of the memo really referred to whether a government official who's in the capacity of national security should be sued or has personal liability if they make a wrong call as far as who was wiretapped, who wasn't. So what he said was, well, we shouldn't have the issue of ruinous personal liability taken into the decision-making process when it comes to acting quickly on issues of national security.
Well, I get that. He was doing his job. But my question is, George, I'll ask this of you. Does it really matter? I mean, as an issue now for him coming up for the U.S. Supreme Court, is this enough to knock him out?
I don't think it's enough to knock him out, but it's a serious issue, especially when everything is, so far has been mostly focused on abortion. I mean, the question here is legal accountability. Can you just let people violate the law or the Constitution or whatever and let them be immune? That is the central issue here. I agree with Tara that some of the central points were not raised in the memo in terms of warrantless searches, but the issue still is whether somebody who violates the law should be immune from prosecution.
Yeah, Walter, what do you say?
Well, I think this issue certainly rises to the top in the vetting process, and I would disagree with Tara to simply say that no matter what capacity he served in as an officer of the court, his first priority is to protect the Constitution, and I think we often lose sight of that. We have a real issue in this problem about a country about executive power and the limits of executive power. My concern is if Alito reaches the high court, will he look the other way when the executive branch abuses power and abuses the Constitution? And I think that cuts to the crust of it. The issue here is not whether or not he wrote a memo specific to this issue, but his general perspective on this issue of limitations of power on the executive branch, I think, becomes very important during a time we have an administration that seems to abuse that power on a daily basis.
Let's look into that a little bit further, because there is something to suggest that he being Alito, has taken the position that perhaps you don't want a full frontal assault on challenging power, but you perhaps might want to slowly chip away at it with regard to reproductive rights or perhaps civil rights or civil liberties on a case-by-case basis. If you agree with that, Tara, is that something to be concerned about?
Well, it depends on how you look at this. I think he recognizes that first of all, I think that it's important that he, as a as a judge, that he does look at each case individually without a full agenda. There are some judges that have that legislate from the bench, and they look at an issue, the whole issue, and they say, "Well, what can I do from the bench to rule in favor of the issue as a whole?" As opposed to looking at cases on an individual basis and applying the law to that specific case. That's a very important distinction to make, and I think that Samuel Alito has demonstrated that. He does not take a personal agenda into the courtroom. He does look at individual cases specifically and very carefully. He's a very particular legal thinker, and I think that's important. And that's what makes a good judicial, good jurist.
What does this writing say to you, George? Are we able to discern enough about him to know what his leanings are likely to be based on what we have seen so far?
With his record, there's no question about that. And this whole hogwash about each judge legislating from the bench, they all claim to look at cases individually. No judge there says that we don't look at individual cases. So that's a complete hogwash. So, yes, it's exactly we know where he ruled. That's why Bush picked him. That's why the right wing were happy finally with the second go-around, because the way he's likely to rule.
But now, what I hear you saying, Walter, also is that even though we now have a clearer picture, perhaps, of who Samuel Alito is and how he is likely to rule once he's on the Supreme Court, if he is in fact nominated, that there is not enough of an opposition to him to even prevent his nomination from going forward.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that. I mean, I think there are some Republicans that are now troubled by this latest revelation. I think the real issue here becomes whether or not you have a jurist on this bench who has some clear notions of this issue of executive power, limitations of power. Part of what we're struggling with here is the balance of the nation's highest court. Sandra Day O'Connor played the role of being the balance on the court. If you lose that balance, what does it mean in terms of the constitutional rights of individuals? The issue of wiretapping becomes important, not necessarily because of Alito's specifics on this issue, but his overall view about the power of government and the invasion of private citizens' rights. I think we're living in a time where more and more we're seeing the government sort of move beyond boundaries, comfortable boundaries, and entering into the private domain of citizens. The notion that you can eavesdrop on citizens is a very frightening notion in a country of this tremendous power and a government that is this powerful. So I think the question for me comes down to the fact of whether or not we are going to put someone on the bench who has no problems with the executive branch of the United States government invading the privacy of citizens. If that is his view, then I think this nominee should be knocked down.
What? The question? Oh, go ahead, George. You want to chime in?
No, that was terrible. That's okay. I'll take up our time. No, the issue certainly is an issue of checks and balances. If you don't have the checks, what happens to our country? And that's the whole way it was set up, so that the executive branch can't do whatever it wants to do. But if a judicial branch is going to give them carte blanche on it, we lose that check and balance.
I want to make sure that I'm clear on this, because I understand the point of view that both of you are making and that Tara is making as well. But my question to the two of you is this. Does any of that matter? And will it stop the nomination? And I hear you both suggesting that it will not.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying it could. I think there are Republicans who in the last several days have raised serious concerns over this latest revelation, because these are the same Republicans who are raising serious concerns over the breaches by the National Security Agency. So I think there is something going on Capitol Hill now around this Alito nomination. And for many people who thought that this was a done deal, I'm suggesting it may not, because I don't think it's just Democrats who are troubled by this notion of constitutional rights being violated and a potential Supreme Court justice who is saying he doesn't have problems with the extent of executive power and not putting a check on that power.
And I don't think they will derail it. I disagree. I mean, I don't think it will. I mean, I just simply don't. It should, but I don't think it will. I just don't think it's there. I mean, you hear Republicans that I expect to say, well, I'm going to question them on that. That's basically all he's said. And so, yeah, they'll get questioned. The candidate will come in already knowing what the question is going to be. We'll have these little rehearsed answers, and they'll get sailed through.
Let me just say that we lost Tara Settmeyer. Hopefully she'll be able to rejoin us before our roundtable discussion ends. Let's move on to another topic. which is also sort of dovetailed with what we are just talking about with regard to leaks in executive power and abuses of executive power. The president has been meeting with newspaper editors to apparently squelch unflattering stories. The White House has been lauded, as you both know, uncriticized for its leak-proof administration. Are the chinks in the armor finally showing through, or is this just good old hardball political arm twisting, George?
First of all, I am appalled and upset and disappointed that the New York Times sat on this story for a year. And now we have reports that not only the New York Times, Washington Post have been meeting with Bush. For him, you know, basically got a commander-in-chief turned to editor-in-chief of these newspapers. And that's horrendous. So, you know, they go in to be patriots and say, oh, we don't want to do anything that hurt our country. And they say they omitted some items from the last New York Times piece. But in the end, the president shouldn't be deciding what's to be published. I mean, that should be an independent decision, and they don't need to be meeting with him. So I'm very disappointed as a journalist who's been in this business 35 years.
What about you, Walter?
Well, you know, considering our experiences with Watergate, I've been troubled from day one with the coziness of the established media with this administration. I think if you go back and you look at the beginnings of the Iraq War and this notion that you had media playing into the hands of the administration, putting embeds with soldiers, adopting the military code name Operation Iraqi Freedom in the marketing of their war coverage, the media has been far too cozy with this administration. I think this is just another example. Instead of playing the role that we would hope the media would play, which is being objective, but also being very hard on our government in terms of these critical issues that face Americans, we find time and again the media playing the role of really, you know, apologists oftentimes for an administration. And I think this is another example. I think it was wrong for the editors of these newspapers to meet with the administration on these stories. If those issues of national security were that paramount, I believe that these newspapers would have never run those stories. But once again, we have a situation where this administration plays heavy-handed and the media just sort of goes along with it.
When is, Tara, quote, in the national interest, end quote, a legitimate enough concern to bend the rules? And are we in that posture now?
Well, I don't know what newspapers Walter is reading, but in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, major newspapers in this country have been far from apologists of this administration. The argument may have been made after 9/11 that the newspapers were a little more favorable to the administration, given the climate in the country. But since the Iraq War has begun, not long after, the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times have printed vicious attacks against this administration, unfair stories. They have not presented the economy properly. They don't present the positives in the war, the successes we've achieved. It's been negative, negative, negative coverage, which is part of the reason why the administration's approval rating was so low. And I've said this many times before, and there have been many studies about that. Now, as far as the president speaking with editors, or the editors meeting with the president of the United States, we have a problem here with compromising national security interests when newspaper media establishments have an agenda to thwart the war or to make this president and the administration look as though they're imperialists or we shouldn't be there. There's an agenda, clearly, with these major newspapers. And I think the administration has said, listen, we're not trying to tell you what stories to run and what not to run. We understand and appreciate the freedom of the press.
Do you really believe that?
Yes, I do. What they're saying is take some consideration into the national security interests. For example, the Washington Times,
one of the problems is that you're suggesting, number one, I don't know what version of the New York Times and Los Angeles Times you're reading, but it took them almost 2 years before they began to critique the Iraq War. The notion that they are responsible for the president's low approval ratings is silly. The president's responsible for his low approval ratings. And the notion that you have a media that somehow or another stands by and, you know, lobbies at this administration is absolutely false.
This administration has gotten so many buys
by the media. It's not funny.
George, let me bring George in on this, because as a publisher, I'm curious. If the president calls you, George, and says, look, I have a concern, the story that you want to run is going to jeopardize national security. Are you saying that as a publisher, you would not give any credence to what the president might ask you to do?
Well, I think you're taking a case by case. But I don't see anything necessarily with the meeting with them if you really have concern. But I do see something wrong with after meeting with them, you sit on the story for a year. Mm-hmm. It's nothing wrong with listening to the concerns. Nothing wrong with it. But it's something wrong with listening to concern and then going and sit on the story for a year. You know, this thing is I don't know what Tyra been reading either. I mean, certainly Bush has really controlled his media more than most presidents in recent issues. And I've covered the White House in the past. And what has happened is he had said anybody who leaks will be fired, and you find out the people doing the leaking have been the people in his own administration, and nobody's been fired, and that's how the press has been manipulated.
All right, now we've sort of exhausted our time on that subject, and clearly we could go a lot further, so perhaps it'll be something we can pick up again on Roundtable. We've got less than a minute, and because we talked about some pretty heavy-duty subjects, we want to end on a little lighter note. I know it's kind of a rough transition. But in less than a minute or so, let me just ask all of you, it is Christmas time. Are any of you going to return your Christmas gifts today? Are you going to keep everything you got?
I don't mess with Santa Claus. I love every gift.
You're
going to
keep all your gifts?
I'm keeping
Tara, you keeping all your gifts?
I'm keeping all of my gifts. I would never return any gifts. How dare you put us on the spot that way.
George, you returning your gifts?
No, I'm not. This may be the first time Tara's and I have ever agreed anything.
No, stop it, George. We agree sometimes.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm returning a gift. And what can I tell you?
Don't say which one.
That's right.
Apparently, it's a big deal now. People are not returning gifts as much as they used to. The gift cards are working. So that's what you should give next year, a gift card, if you don't want to worry about it being returned. Let me end by saying, in our New York Bureau, Walter Fields, CEO, publisher of the North Star Network. From Washington, D.C., Tara Settmeyer and George Curry, Editor-in-Chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association. Thank you all for a wonderful roundtable.